They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab.
Classic. Can you call an 18-year-old song a classic? I remember when I first heard Back to Black, the album from which that song comes. Released on this day in 2006, Amy Winehouse's Rehab came out as a single. It won 3 Grammy Awards, including Record of the Year, Song of the Year, and Best Female Pop Vocal Performance. Also won an Ivor Novello Award for Best Contemporary Song. And as we all know by now, heck, we knew then, the song was autobiographical, and we lost the very talented Amy Winehouse far too young. Dare I say, the signature song from the album Back to Black. Rehab, released on this day in 2006, begins our program for this Wednesday, the 23rd of October. Good morning. Thank you very much for stopping by. I know that your time is valuable. I know that you've got so many things competing for your attention. But the fact that you spend some time here with us really means a lot. So thank you very much for that. Took full advantage of our not quite record-setting weather yesterday, as you heard from Jill Taylor throughout all news mornings today with Christine Clark and Mark Douglas. Close but no cigar when it came to another temperature record, but nonetheless, an absolutely glorious fall day. And so I took full advantage to be outside wearing shorts to cut the grass. That's right. I want you to get the mental image this morning of my pasty white legs out in the backyard, cutting the grass. Now, I don't know about you. Is it just me? When you cut the grass, when you're finished, you always take the time to admire your work, right? Because you do a really good job at it. No? That's just a me thing all these years? Anyway, I must have been drunk when I cut the grass yesterday because my lines are terrible. And the worst part is I'm now stuck with them, right? Until spring. I might just go out and do one more cut in early November so I don't have to look at the crooked, drunken lines I put on my back lawn yesterday. What an embarrassment. It's a good thing it's the back lawn. If I ever cut the front lawn like that, the neighbors would really be concerned. Hey, this guy's not taking good enough care of his property. Look at those terrible lines on the lawn. Nonetheless, while it's not quite as warm today as it has been these last couple of days, certainly the beautiful fall weather continues. I'll take it, like my buddy Jim said at the Kitchener Rangers game the other day, I'll take this weather right through April, please, and then it can get even warmer. Something I talked about at the beginning of the show yesterday, and I will update you before 9:30, right around 9:25, but I don't know why, I won't go so far as to say I doubted you, because I never doubt you and your good nature. And the fact that you are one of those good people, of which 85% of us are, right? Anyway, you came through in a really big way to remedy however small a problem. And I appreciate you for it. I'll give you that update right around 9:25 this morning. So about 15 minutes from now.
1, 2, 3.
right now, let's get to your Farwell Show 5 for this Wednesday morning. Number one, the investigation continues into a sudden death in Kitchener overnight. Police called to the home on Weber Street East, where a man had been found unresponsive. He was transported to hospital and later pronounced dead. Number two, today is the day that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will face the music from within his own party. The federal Liberals are holding a caucus meeting during which an undetermined number of MPs will reportedly call for Trudeau to step down. Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland won't be one of them.
I am absolutely confident, and more confident after conversations I've been having in Ottawa over the past 36 hours than ever, that the vast majority of Liberal MPs support the Prime Minister, support him as leader of our government today, support him as leader of our party, and support him as the guy who's going to lead us into the next election.
Number three on your Farwell Show 5 this morning, former President Barack Obama appeared at a rally last night for Democratic nominee Kamala Harris. Obama was introduced by rapper Eminem.
I also think that people shouldn't be afraid to express their opinions. And I don't think anyone wants an America where people are worried about retribution or what people will do if you make your opinion known. I think Vice President Harris supports a future for this country where these freedoms and many others will be protected and upheld.
Number four on your Farwell Show 5 this morning, the Ontario government's plan to issue $200 rebate checks to every Ontarian has hit a stumbling block. In order to collect all the names and addresses, the Ontario government is going to need the support of the Canada Revenue Agency. The rebate plan is expected to be formally announced in next week's fall economic statement. And number five, the KW Titans are holding an open tryout this weekend in search of the next star to join their team. The tryout is being held at the Cheer Sport Sharks Tank on New Dundee Road at 1 p.m. Saturday. Everyone who registers will be given a fair evaluation and the chance to earn an invitation to the Titans' main training camp. And that is your Farwell Show 5 for this Wednesday morning. A quick break. After this break, the Big City Mayor's Caucus met here in Ontario last week, and they are applying some pressure on the provincial government to maybe consider something along the lines of involuntary treatment for people addicted to drugs. What does the mayor of Cambridge think about that? And how would you like $500,000 or likely more? I'll tell you how you could get your hands on it. That's coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. Ontario's big city mayors met last Friday. And yes, by big city, we mean the mayors of Kitchener, Cambridge, Waterloo, Guelph, London, Barrie, Oshawa. There are a lot. Kingston's in there too. But our local mayors, a part of this meeting, and there was a strong focus on increasing homelessness, encampments, addiction in our communities. And what was discussed by this group of big city mayors at their meeting last Friday was a motion calling on the provincial government for legislative change that would allow for, quote, a system of mandatory, community-based and residential mental health and addictions treatment facilities. Even going so far as to suggest the provincial and federal governments invoke the notwithstanding clause to prevent likely constitutional challenges in the future and ensure that individuals in need are able to access treatment. Now, that motion was softened a little bit by the end of the meeting, but the idea is there that upper levels of government need to provide greater support to lower tier municipalities. And Cambridge Mayor Jan Liggett appeared on TVO's The Agenda the other night talking about this.
We also need courts to enforce, once the police bring that forward, we We need the courts to be able to have some sort of verdict come down as to what happens to the people. And with the lack of resources for that, it really gets very difficult. There are some municipalities where the police actually will walk up and take drugs away from people when they see that happening. But we also have a provincial chief of police association who sort of makes up the rules for all of the police departments. So until they start all doing that, we're not going to get anywhere.
Which is what you want? You want them all to do that?
Yes, I would like to see them all do that, because that gives the incentive to the addict. If they can't find another drug source quickly, then they have to look at what they're going to do to help themselves out of situations.
Might be a little bit simplistic that the person who is addicted would help themselves, so to speak, but nonetheless, a little bit, kind of the gist there of what was discussed at the Big City Mayor's Caucus last week. And we'll get into more of that. There's some rather compelling audio from the mayor of Oshawa from that appearance on TVO's The Agenda this week. We'll get to that later on in the show, and hopefully bring a bigger conversation to the show later this week. Something else I wanted to let you know about this morning, because gosh darn it, it's important, and it could put $500,000 in your pocket. That doesn't sound so bad, does it? It's an opportunity for you to win that kind of money and support your local hospital at the same time. Our friends at the Split the Pot Lottery have launched a new lottery that supports 68 hospitals across Ontario, including those here in the region of Waterloo and Wellington County as well, while giving Ontarians multiple chances to win cash prizes. Paul McIntyre Royston is a good friend of the show. He's the president and CEO of the Grand River Hospital Foundation. And I thought, let's give PMR a call to talk about this. And Paul, let's just start with what this money can do for our local hospitals here in the region.
Well, what's great about it is, in fact, all the hospitals locally benefit, because we're all in the split the pot. But it focuses on equipment, at least for us, because we know that 100% of the equipment we have in the hospital has to be funded locally. We've done our tools of care campaign. You have this idea like every bedpan, every pole, every MRI has to be funded locally. That's what makes the system work. And so it's perfect. Split the pot is just an amazing way to help that.
And the first early bird deadline for a prize is this very night. It's tonight.
It is, yeah. And there's, I think we have an early bird deadline every single week with over $100,000 in extra prizes as we go.
And if you buy tickets early, I just want to make sure I've got this right, you're in still for all of the draws. Even if you win one of those early birds, your ticket remains in.
Absolutely. We haven't had someone win both an early bird and the jackpot, but it's entirely possible.
All right. How do we go about, most importantly, getting our hands on these Split the Pot lottery tickets?
It's super easy. Splitthepot.ca. And that's what's really special about this as a lottery, is we're truly splitting the pot. There are a lot of winners. We've heard from time and time again that people want to see more winners in these draws. So we really feel it delivers.
All right. Splitthepot.ca. And there is a guarantee prize of $500,000 in this. Like, is it PMR? Are you putting up your own money on this? Are we willing? Are we winning Ben Stein / PMR's money? What's going on here?
Well, the great part is, that was a great show. The great part is, it really is, we have over 66 hospitals involved, right, across the province. And that's great, because that gets the numbers up. A, all of these hospitals support, and Grand River's leading the charge, but it truly is all the hospitals sort of pitching in, putting in together, and they all benefit across the province. So that's why we're able to get the jackpot where it's going to be.
Fantastic. First early bird deadline tonight, splitthepot.ca is the website we can use to get our tickets.
You betcha.
PMR, always great talking to you. Thank you for this.
You too. Enjoy your day.
Paul McIntyre Royston, a.k.a. PMR, President and CEO of the Grand River Hospital Foundation, joining us to talk a little bit more about the Split the Pot lottery. The first early bird deadline is tonight. You can buy your tickets at splitthepot.ca. Remember, if you buy them before that early bird draw tonight, you're still in the remainder of those draws, including the grand prize draw, which offers that minimum jackpot of $500,000. And just something to keep in mind, you know, the holidays are coming up. Split the pot tickets, not a bad gift idea, right? You give the gift of giving back, and the chance to the recipient to win. Tickets can be purchased online at splitthepot.ca. All right, a quick break. When we come back, how you came through in a very big way yesterday. That's coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. You may recall yesterday morning me sharing the story with you about a couple of places that I knew that had Halloween decorations stolen from their yard. One, my buddy's neighbor. I'm visiting my buddy. We're on the front porch having a chat. I comment on the neighbor's display next door. He's like, yeah, it used to be better until some stuff got stolen. The neighbor had posted a homemade cardboard box sign saying, I'm not going to keep replacing these things because they keep getting stolen, etc. And then was also shared with me the house that many of us affectionately know. And in fact, the owner himself calls himself the crazy Christmas guy with the house on the corner of East Avenue and Pandora in Kitchener, who also does a pretty decent Halloween display and also had several hundred dollars worth of items stolen in the overnight hours on a few separate occasions. So I shared these stories with you yesterday, and I did take my buddy's words to heart when I was talking to him about his neighbor's place. And I said, you know, like, people suck. They're ruining a good place, you know, and we're just getting some joy in the neighborhood from these people that go the extra mile to decorate for Halloween, for Christmas, whatever. And my buddy said to me, they do. But he says, not everybody sucks. It's just that the people who do suck kind of suck a lot, right? And my buddy, as usual, is so right, because I received an update from Crazy Christmas Guy at East Avenue and Pandora yesterday. And he said one of your listeners heard the story. Bottom line is, he found a bunch of stuff and made efforts to return it to other homeowners today. And me and most of the stuff is back now. In fact, Crazy Christmas Guy at East and Pandora got so much stuff back from this listener, from you, that not all of it was his. So he's now reposting on Facebook to find the owner of some of the stuff that was brought back that was not his to begin with. So listen, thank you for reminding me, A, that my buddy is always right, and B, that people don't suck. Just those who do suck can, you know, those who jackwagon a lot, right? But the rest of us, I mean, gosh darn it, what a great place. And you heard the story yesterday, and you went out of your way to try to get the stuff back to Crazy Christmas, a.k.a. Crazy Halloween Guy on East Avenue and Pandora, just because you heard about it on the show. I call that the Farwell Show bump. Sometimes it's just a little thing, but we get it done here on the show. Thanks to you. All right, an update from the 570 News Center is on the way. And then, what would you say if your child was put into a split class? But not a split of two grades, three grades in one classroom. We'll talk to a mother in Kitchener who's not exactly thrilled with that for her son. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio. Time for us to update or get some more information on a story we talked about last week. And this story surrounds the reorganization of some classrooms within public schools here in our region. And I pointed out last week when this story first came up, because just imagine, it's Thanksgiving, and you as a student and you as a family learn that your young one is no longer going to be in the class he or she started the school year in, but going to be moved, shuffled into a new classroom. And I pointed out at the time that when I went to school, and I know I'm being that guy, well, you know, back in my day, I can tell you the number of times I changed classrooms anytime during the school year. And the number of times was zero. It just didn't happen. And so apparently this is becoming more regular. And in one case, and the case we're about to learn more about, it's not just the shuffling of a classroom, it's the creation of a split classroom. And not just the kind of split classroom that I was in back in the day. I did have a grade 5-6 split. This is a 3-grade split in one classroom, grades 4, 5, and 6. Daryl Morris joins me in studio. Daryl's son is in one of those, in that 4-5-6 split class, after that long-winded introduction. Good morning, and thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So can you take us through the process of what happened at your son's school?
Sure. So it will have been 3 Mondays ago now. We got an email from the school, from the principal, talking about there's been some unfortunate reorganization that's had to happen because the ministry, the school board told us we need to eliminate a teaching position from our school. I'm not sure. I think that teacher got reassigned. And they said the class this impacts most is the grade 4 French immersion. So there was a core grade 4 French immersion class. I think it was just grade 4s. They took the students from that class and they moved some of them into the grade 3 to make a 3-4 split. And then they moved 5 of them into our already 5-6 split class. So now we have a 4-5-6 and it's 25 students. So you're already beyond the actual like class size limit that the ministry says for this age group, grades 4 to 8. And but not only that, now you have a teacher that has to teach 3 different grade levels. And my initial response to this was like, what? This can happen? In a city the size of Waterloo, this can happen. You know, my son's been in split classes since kindergarten, and that's just been a fact. We do have a pretty small school, but it raises the question of, well, should this school be even offering French immersion if we can't have the students for it? And all you hear is how hard it is to get your kid into French immersion, how there's no spots, and now we've lost a French teacher from our school and made this hybrid monster of a class.
How has your son reacted and responded to it?
So he, being a child, was pretty upset. It meant that his actual French teacher had to move to a different school, and he got back a teacher that he'd had for 2 grades before. And it meant that, you know, some kids that maybe he doesn't get along with the best were moving into his class. That's all stuff, I mean, as an adult, you have to learn how to navigate different personalities. But I think, you know, I get the sense that already the attention is pretty split. And when they're teaching, say, the grade 6s, the grade 5s are on their Chromebooks, right? And vice versa. And so I just feel like there's probably a lot more time during class now where he's on his Chromebook with busy work.
How do you feel about what has happened? I mean, you make the point, in a community of this size, how can it be happening? But how are you navigating this?
Well, we spoke with the principal. His father and I had a short meeting with the principal, and we all agreed, you know, give this a week or two, see how it goes. But at the same time, like, I feel for the teachers. I don't think this is fair for them. I don't think it's fair for the kids at all. I already don't like split classes. And I think what I just feel more than anything is so frustrated with the way the board does not communicate with parents. Nobody reached out before and said, this is a real possibility. You know, nobody said, this is what happens when we make what they're calling family classes, by the way. And I'm frustrated with the response seems to be that no one's really listening or no one really cares, because I think we need to say, hey, this is happening. And if you just let this go, it's going to happen again next year. It's going to start happening at more schools. And what is breaking down with the ministry that they're okay with this reality too, right? Like, someone needs to say no enough. Like, education is one of the most important things in our society that we have. And you don't, as a parent, expect to send your kid to a public school in Ontario and then get a subpar education, right? We always talk about falling behind other countries in the world. Well, why are we doing this now?
Yeah. I think that's an excellent point. You don't, especially in this province and this country and all the wealth that we have and all the resources that we have, a subpar education doesn't cut it.
And you hear all this talk from Doug Ford and from former Minister Lecce about common sense education and back to basics and budgeting and all these things for the high school level. Well, you're already setting them up to be at a disadvantage when you do this in elementary school. I think about the grade 6s in this class. Next year, they're off to a grade 7-8 school where now they have timetables and different classrooms. But you're putting them in with grade 4s who are at a totally different emotional and mental mindset, right?
I know that you have undertaken a great deal of effort, Daryl, to get answers from the school, from the school board, et cetera. Yeah. And we've heard from the head of the local chapter of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario. I want to get into this a little further. If you can hang around with
us,
please. All right. Daryl Morris in studio with us. Daryl's son in a French immersion class is now part of a family class, grades 4, 5, and 6, all in one classroom with one teacher. We continue the conversation on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. Daryl Morris is in studio with us. Daryl's son at a public elementary school here in the region is now in a family class, which contains 3 grades in one classroom with one teacher. What efforts have you made, Daryl? You talked about you and your son's father having a meeting with the principal to try to understand this. Let's give it a couple of weeks. What other efforts have you made to try to find out how this happens and what these processes are all about?
So me being me, I immediately fire off an email and I'm CCing the school board, the director of education, my trustees for Waterloo Wilmot, the chair of the trustee board, MPP Fife's office. Like, I just want somebody to acknowledge this is not okay. I want somebody to know that it's happening, first of all, because I did hear through the grapevine the initial response from the school board was, this isn't happening at any of our schools. No, I have the email from the principal. I've spoken to the principal. It's happening, right? So I've been trying to get in touch with as many people at the school board as possible and within the trustees. And I've had some responses back, but they're very generic, unsatisfactory, and it baffles me that no one's saying, okay, come talk to us, work with us, let's talk to the ministry about this, let's get the government's attention on this. Like, no one said that. It's like no one wants to do anything. It's very frustrating.
Jeff Pellick, who is the head of the local chapter of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, said to me when I first brought this up that some change does happen every year, but never as much as this year. And I'm quoting from Jeff now. To be honest, he says, it is unprecedented. We have asked the trustees to investigate why enrollment seems to be down in the WRDSB. The official response has been silence. It's frustrating. I get the sense, Daryl, that you're sharing a similar frustration here.
And I think that's the question for me and for some other parents I've talked to is, well, what are the enrollment numbers? You know, how small was too small to justify having a teacher for that class. That now we have situations where one mom I talked to, there were 3 kindergarten classes. They dissolved one of them, and now the 2 classes have 31 kindergartners each. You know, I don't understand why having a smaller class size can't be okay sometimes. And it obviously comes down to funding. And we also know for split classes, the board gets more funding for a split class than they do for a 1-grade class, and it's got to come down to money somewhere. But if it's about money, where are these teachers going and who are you hiring? And I want numbers, you know, I want data. I want real information to tell me this is what enrollment was. This is what it is now. This is how much of now of a deficit we have because we've lost so many students. And then I want them to ask themselves, well, why are you losing students? Why are more going over to the Catholic board? You know, there has to be a reason. And I think the frustration for a lot of parents is that this school board has been really awful about being communicative with families. And I think even, you know, when's the last time you remember the director of education talking to anyone in local media? We don't hear from these people. And so we don't hear why you make the decisions you make. And maybe if we heard from you, we'd understand better. But we just feel like we're getting blocked out and we're not owed any answers. But we're the taxpayers, you know? Like, there's so many questions, and I would love for someone to actually answer these questions for us.
I think you make a great point there, Daryl, that you have, you know, 2 stakes really in this game. One, as the taxpayer who funds this system that your son is in, and then there's the second stake. You are the parent of a child, and you want that child to receive the very best possible educational experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you at with this as a family? It's been a couple to a few weeks. Right. Are you just going to ride this out? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, so we've considered options. I mean, his father and I aren't together, so we live in two different school zones. So there is the option there of looking at, do we move him into the public school that's French immersion in my zone if we can? I mean, I'm baptized Catholic. Do we put him into the Catholic board? We're looking at all of these things. Of course, when you're dealing with a kid, he's got emotions about it. Like, we've talked with him about it. And, you know, he has his friends, and he spent his whole school career at this school. But that being said, if we were to change him schools, by grade 7, he'd be back with those friends at the school they feed into anyway. So that is on the table, and we've talked with him about maybe seeing how it goes till Christmas, maybe seeing what the situation would be like next year, because my fear is that this class stays a 4, 5, 6 again next year, and that's not okay.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really too bad we're not yet on our Rogers TV simulcast, because without question, people would recognize your face if they don't just recognize the name Daryl Morris, long time with CTV Kitchener, recently having left there and started off on your own venture.
And once here, too.
And once, I know, news. Way back when, in the old building. Did you ever get into this one?
No, you guys
did.
Got a glow up after I left.
We got a pretty serious upgrade from those old studios. Not that I didn't love downtown Kitchener. Did you imagine yourself, Daryl, becoming an advocate like this so soon after leaving the public eye as a member of the media?
Not this soon, no. I mean, I think a lot of us get into journalism because we feel passionate about shining a light on things, and sometimes in your role as a journalist, it's a little difficult because you have to remain neutral and report on what you're observing. And so this feels very awkward to be on the other side of it. But at the same time, it is shining the light on something that, you know, I think every single person's reaction to me when they hear about this is what? Right. So I know I'm not alone in thinking that this is wrong and this can't be the way that we're going to go about educating our kids for the next however many years.
Do you get any sense early on in this advocacy that you're making traction, that there might be some movement here?
Yeah, I think in the last few days, there's been a lot more people interested in it, people listening to it. And then I did get an email from the superintendent's assistant this morning saying they'd like to have a phone meeting this week, which is great. But I feel for parents who maybe don't have the same avenues I have to bring up issues, and then they're waiting. You know, who knows how long I would have waited for them to actually acknowledge that we should sit down and have a meeting.
Kudos to you for being the voice of those who might also be voiceless in all of this. It's important. And thanks for stopping by. I hope you like our fancy new studios.
I love it. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for listening to my complaints and frustrations. It's always nice to know that, you know, there are people that are willing to hear you out and take you up and try to get some attention and traction on your issue.
Justified concerns, to be sure, and hopefully from your lips to the public school board's ears. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio. I just want to quickly share a quote from the story in this morning's Waterloo Region Record about the issue you just heard about. Daryl Morris, a mom of a child who's now in a family class. A three-way grade split, 4, 5, and 6, one classroom, one teacher. And Public School Board Trustee Scott Piatkowski is quoted as saying, "Realistically, the best that we can do is ask our leadership team to work with our labor partners to make the process less painful. Unfortunately, that is not always possible." What's your job? Like, if you're a trustee for a school board, your job literally is to advocate on behalf of the people whose children, the parents in that board. Like, I don't understand. And yesterday on this show, we talked about the issue at Shepherd Public School, where after 4 years, these facility dogs who provide support to staff and students alike are being removed from the school, and nobody's talking to anybody about it. Like, this is what trustees should do. And this is why I say, if you can't do that, if you can't do the basic advocacy on the part of families within the school system, then we don't need you anymore. Like, I'm so done with school boards of trustees. I am so done with them. What a waste, an absolute waste of time. Walter is on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Walter.
Yes, hello, good morning, Mike. You stole my thunder right out from underneath me. Like, I cannot believe that the school board is actually doing this. Now, I heard the frustration in your guest voice, obviously, but Mike, when is the next municipal election?
2026. Vote all the bums out, Walter. All of them.
That's what I was going to say. That's how you get it out. But you know something? It's unfortunate, but most people know more about you than they do the school board trustees because, like the last municipal election, I tried to get some information on them, and like it was like trying to pull hen's teeth. Like nobody goes door to door, and like these people are elected. Nobody's out in the public. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, but most of them. And it's a joke. I'm 100% behind you, Mike. Kick the bums out.
All right, Walter. Appreciate the call. Let's squeeze in one more. Steve, I got about 60 seconds before the news update.
Hey, Mike. How are you this morning?
Good, thanks.
Just like to share, yeah, we have a couple of kids in the public school board this year. Every year we kind of look at what's best avenue for us. Unfortunately, the frustrations from lack of decision-making, clarity, communication is one of the frustrations we have as parents. Fortunately, we've had good communications with our principals and educators, which has kept us in that board for now. But it's all about the people our children are going to spend the time with for us. As for the school boards, in my dealings, I view it kind of like a machine. And you need to know what gears to push or what buttons to push to make the next gears move. And it takes a while to figure out what that is and how to go about that. And it's not easy for parents, that's for sure. So, this is happening in a lot of the schools and the boards. You know, realignments, classes, splits, movement of kids 2 months into school. We can point to the eclipse day last year that happened, unique to the Waterloo board, where it seemed like every other board had it figured out how to move a PD day and make it safe and for the kids. And then we sat to the last day and forced parents into those decisions. So I believe those are some of the reasons why kids and parents are choosing other avenues for their education. So,
Steve, I appreciate that call and your thoughts on this. And again, are you in it for the kids? Are you in it to support the families or not? This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio. We are smack in the middle of Media Literacy Week, 21st to the 25th. Here we are on the 23rd. And the Canadian Journalism Foundation has launched, in recognition of Media Literacy Week, Trust Wisely, which is a national campaign in collaboration with news publishers across the country. The message, says the Canadian Journalism Foundation, is simple but powerful. Your trust is valuable. Choose wisely where you place it. Jeffrey Dvorkin is a senior fellow with Massey College at the University of Toronto, joins us for a conversation. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Does this week, Media Literacy Week, strike you as more important than ever as it rolls around again this year in 2024?
Well, there's certainly a lot to consider these days, both in Canada and from the United States. We're looking at an outpouring of claims and counterclaims. And as it happens, I wrote a book called Trusting the News in a Digital Age, which I list for mostly, I did this when I was teaching at the University of Toronto Scarborough, for my students, 18, 19, 20-year-old students who were kind of overwhelmed by everything out there. And so I thought it would be useful to give them a kind of a handy home guide to how to figure out what the heck is going on. So one of the things that I've done is that to differentiate between misinformation, which is your Uncle Fred sends you something and says, hey, have you seen this? It's hilarious. And disinformation, which is a deliberate distorting and lying of facts in order to undermine your confidence in anything, whether it's the media or government or churches or universities. They are all being undermined now by these awful websites, which cause you to say and cause my students to say, well, I don't know what's going on. So I wrote this book for them and for the general public, basically to say, start developing your sense of whether you can trust a source or not. And I think that this has proven to be, I'm told, quite useful for a lot of people. And one of the things that I've suggested is that if it looks too good to be true, it probably isn't true. And you have to start, the public and the students and all of us have to start developing another set of instincts to make sure that what we're consuming, and we're consuming a ton of stuff, comes to us and we can say, well, where does this come from? And who is this from? And what is this website? And does this website actually tell you who's behind it? And if none of those answers can be given, then you cannot trust that medium.
You know, it's so interesting, Jeffrey. Coincidentally, I received a message this morning, unsolicited and unconnected to anything we have recently talked about on the show or will be talking about today, but it was about some bill before the Senate federally that is going to impact ownership of land in this country. And my spidey sense started to tingle, and I thought, you know what, I'll park that over here and I'll look into it more later. But it strikes me that the person who sent the message is like that uncle that you just described, the misinformation agent, but the people who create the disinformation rely on those misinformation agents to confuse the rest of us.
Exactly. And I think that what we're dealing with now is the combination of photoshopping and artificial intelligence, putting all this stuff out for us to consume with no real way of verifying it. And I think the obligation of mainstream media like yours has a kind of an obligation to say, you know, this came in over the digital transom this morning. It's not true. And we have to help each other figure out what is verifiable and what is not. And then to help the public and my students understand that they're being driven in a certain direction, not for all the best of reasons. I'll give you one more example. I would ask my students in the first class of first year journalism, how many of you think that Toronto, that in Ontario in general, is a more dangerous place than ever before? And all the women in the class put their hands up. The men were being, you know, 18, 19 years old and a bit macho, so they didn't put their hands up. But the women all said that they think it's a dangerous place out there. And I said, would it surprise you to know that the crime rate has actually fallen in Ontario since 1970? And they said, well, we can't tell that because, you know, we come on the subway and we look at the TV monitors and it just gives one crime after another. So naturally, we're terrified. And I think that this is part of the obligation that we all have. Crime reporting has replaced real reporting in many instances. And we're seeing this in the U.S. now, where people are saying in this upcoming national election, presidential election, that crime is out of control. Well, in fact, it's not. In fact, the crime rate in the States is lower than it's ever been in the last 10 years. Yet people are nervous. And when they're nervous, they're going to go for a politician who claims to be able to say, well, you can trust me to handle it.
It occurs to me, Jeffrey, that things used to be a whole heck of a lot simpler. Your newspaper would arrive more often than not in the afternoon. You'd watch an evening newscast and all that you needed to know would be delivered that way. Today, and you've talked about the responsibility for mainstream media in vetting and ensuring accuracy, but as the consumer of media as well, you have to be more diligent than ever.
Absolutely. And it's a tough time that we're all in, but we're all in this together, and we have to figure out ways in which, without censoring, we need to figure out a better system of sifting through the information, a better system of triage, basically, that allows the public to develop, as you call it, your spidey sense, and to say, well, this is nonsense, and I'm not going to believe this. And if they're not going to identify themselves on their website, then I'm not going to believe them at all. And I think that there are a couple of ways of doing this. We need to find out where the reporting, where these stories come from. Who's paying for this information? Is the public able to respond to the story in a significant way, or is there no way of contacting them? All of these things will help us become not more suspicious, but just a little more skeptical of what's out there in the media. We can't uninvent the internet, And I'm not sure we'd want to do it anyway. I mean, I enjoy my emails. But I think that we need to be a little more scrupulous in what we allow ourselves to consume.
I always enjoy the conversations, Jeffrey. Thank you very much for making time for another one.
Anytime, Mike.
Bye-bye. Jeffrey Dvorkin is a senior fellow at Massey College, the University of Toronto, has worked previously with National Public Radio News in the United States, CBC here on this side of the border, and he is the author of Trusting the News in a Digital Age. We are in the midst of Media Literacy Week, and the Canadian Journalism Foundation has launched a Trust Wisely national campaign, which claims a simple but powerful message. Your trust is valuable. Choose wisely where you place it. Do you trust generally as a consumer of news these days? Do you raise a Spockian eyebrow with one story or another? How much effort do you put into ensuring that which you are consuming is accurate? Would love to hear from you. Let's have the conversation on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio and Rogers TV.
I think the obligation of mainstream media like yours has a kind of an obligation to say, this came in over the digital transom this morning. It's not true. And we have to help each other figure out what is verifiable and what is not. And then to help the public understand that they're being driven in a certain direction, not for all the best of reason.
Jeffrey Dvorkin is a senior fellow at Massey College, University of Toronto. Worked previously with NPR, National Public Radio News in the U.S., CBC here in Canada. He's the author of a book called Trusting the News in a Digital Age. And as we are in the midst of Media Literacy Week, it occurs to me that our need to be media literate is greater than ever. And listen, I'd love to hear from you on this at 519-570-2545, star 570, and 1-800-570-5715. How do you go about determining, making the choices that you make for consumption of news? The number one thing I do today is consult multiple sources. You know, I alluded to in that conversation with Jeffrey Dvorkin a moment ago that it was so much simpler back in the day, right? You would subscribe to a newspaper, which so many of us did, and it would usually arrive around dinner time, late afternoon. You would watch an evening newscast. You would certainly listen to the radio through the day. Maybe you preferred listening to the evening news. I remember when I was working up in Thunder Bay, and that takes me back to the late 1990s, our 5 and 6 p.m. newscasts were the big ones that we did every day, much like a noon and a 12:30 newscast that we would do. But these were big, long, 10-plus minute radio newscasts. And of course, in this day and age, with our attention spans being what they are, we come at you frequently but in shorter bursts, right? 2-3 minutes at a time sort of thing. And it's all part of how our habits have changed as consumers and how we as media have responded to those habits and continued our efforts to get your attention. But I can certainly understand the importance of vetting anything that you consume, right? You can't just go to one source all the time and consider only that perspective. You can't just go to one source all the time and be certain, unless you've already vetted it, that that source is even reliable. There are so many of those kinds of sites on the internet today that it concerns me. And I'll bet you I spend 30 to 40% of my time throwing cold water, if you will, on ideas that are shared or alleged stories that exist and verifying them or determining them to be false, as I do preparing accurate stuff. Like, it's just, it's incredible to me. And I also mentioned in that conversation with Jeffrey, the message that just came in today about something that, look, I'm never going to sit here and claim to know all of the things. No question about that. But what I do bring to the show is carefully vetted and researched so that we know that we are bringing you an accurate story, right? Whether it comes from a mother who's concerned about the way her child's class has been split up in a local public school, like we heard earlier, whether it's with a financial expert who's going to tell us just after 11 this morning how your coffee is every day is impacting your household budget, right? It'll be their perspective on things, but there's no question that what they will be sharing with us is accurate, vetted, reliable information. If you go to, you know, todaysnews.com, I don't know if that's even a website, but you know, and you're just looking at this one particular place all the time because it gives you something that you find interesting or the kinds of things that you want to hear, you best make sure that it is a verified media source. And I would also submit to you that if you are going to just that one site, even if it is a verified media source, because it's telling you the sorts of things that you want to hear, check another source or two as well, and you could hear some different perspectives. I've said it many times. That's what I love about doing this show. It brings so many different perspectives to a particular issue. We will certainly present it with one perspective, and then we have the opportunity to open our phone lines and hear different perspectives on the same story. That's what I think makes interesting and compelling talk radio. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Few minutes away from 10:30, your update in the 570 News Center. Still time. Go to the phones and hear from you on the show this morning. Jonathan is with us. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. I just wanted to share some thoughts on this, your topic here about news and stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure.
I just have a bit of a personal situation that happened a few weeks ago. Do you believe, like, whatever news sources reporting something, they should, like, even though, like, an individual should always check multiple sources, do you think the news source should do its best to be as transparent and comprehensive as possible, would you say?
Oh, absolutely, without question.
Yeah, I had a bit of an issue with, so I was on a bus back from Michigan last week, and that was when I came across an Instagram post from the Rangers official account saying that Pugliese had been, all the post said was, thank you, Antonino Pugliese. And so I was like, well, concerned or I didn't know what happened. I thought, I didn't know if he got traded or if he was released or whatever. And so I the post didn't specify, it just said thank you. So I just commented, like, I thought it was a confusing post, and I was just wondering what happened. And so I had people started confronting me about why I was asking those questions. And
well, I think this is actually a good example of media literacy here, Jonathan, too, because what an organization like a hockey team or any private institution, not public, says or how it communicates is different than how a news source might communicate, right?
Right, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
yeah, so any private company, if it wants to say, you know, so-and-so is no longer the CEO of the company, we wish her the best of luck in her future endeavors. That's all they need to say as a private company. But when you're talking about news and how you're consuming what the media provides, it's a different story.
Okay, so maybe I was wrong to question that and stuff, but
you're never wrong to question it. I'm just using this as an example of what we're considering media, right? And we're talking about media sources, news organizations, as opposed to privately run entities.
Yeah, that's a good distinction, I guess, to think about. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for talking about this. It's important, I think. So.
Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate the call and the conversation. That's what the show is all about. I'm going to get you to the 570 News Center for that aforementioned update. And then let's challenge some stereotypes, shall we? Particularly stereotypes surrounding people with Down syndrome. That's coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. It started with a simple enough idea. Let's create a photo calendar featuring people with Down syndrome as a means of raising funds for the Waterloo Wellington Down Syndrome Society. And here we are now a decade later, and after 10 years, we have not only shattered stereotypes and raised funds for the Waterloo Wellington Down Syndrome Society, but I think also created something that perhaps 10 years ago we never envisioned would be created. Hillary Gauld joins the program this morning. Hillary is the photographer behind the photo series and the calendar and always makes time for the show. Hillary, it's nice to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Absolute pleasure. Along with Hillary is Tara Hart, who's a board member with the Waterloo Wellington Down Syndrome Society. Tara, good morning.
Good morning.
Hillary, let's start with you. I mean, these 10 years, they must feel like they've flown by, but take us back to the beginning of this effort to put the faces of people with Down syndrome into a calendar and what that meant.
Well, this, like you said, it started 10 years ago when my friend Kate Heron had a son born with Down syndrome. His name is Caleb. And she came to me and just said, we do this calendar and would you be interested in photographing our members since we're looking for a photographer? And when I did the first photo shoot, I remember going home and just searching imagery online for people with Down syndrome and being really quite shocked at how little imagery existed 10 years ago, and the imagery that did exist just didn't align with the people that I had met in terms of portraying them in an authentic way. And so when I look back to 10 years ago, what existed online then and what we've done in the last 10 years to what exists online today, we should all really be celebrating.
Tara, did you ever envision that this initiative could have the impact that it has had?
Well, I certainly was shocked with how well received it was. I have to say that this really, in so many ways, has been Hillary's vision. She's just always striving to make it bigger and reach more people, which has been such a blessing for our organization. I think her discussion with Kate about adding that social media campaign, that advocacy piece to it instead of just having it be a calendar, was really key. And you know what that has done in the past 10 years is really something that's quite phenomenal.
What has it meant to the Down Syndrome Society, Tara?
Well, I think, you know, for our organization, I mean, it's been a really beautiful thing to be at the center of this with Hillary. But just, I think, our broader worldwide community with Down syndrome, it's been a beautiful thing as a parent of a child with Down syndrome to see so much positive representation in the media and so much beautiful imagery starting to be out there. And for our kids and, you know, for adults with Down syndrome and children with Down syndrome to be able to see themselves in the faces on social media or in movies or TV or in ads. I think the past 10 years, the inclusivity and the representation has been outstanding, and we're just excited to continue to see growth in that area.
Hillary, what have you learned over the past 10 years of working on this project annually?
I think it's really become clear to me, you know, when we say representation matters, I think I now fully understand what it means to represent communities in an authentic way. And I've really learned how to, you know, listen to people and to, you know, open up my own mind and challenge my own beliefs on people and what they can do. And I think that, you know, now that these children and adults, like Tara said, can see themselves represented on a bigger, you know, in the bigger world in a more authentic way, I think that that's probably one of the biggest things I've learned.
So, Hillary, how do you mark 10 years of doing this? How do you mark a decade?
Well, we had thought a couple years ago that it would be very important to mark this occasion because it is a huge milestone. In order to be this committed to something every single year, the families come out and support. We tackle a new stereotype or misconception every year. And, you know, we felt an event would be the best way to celebrate, that we could bring everyone together, because obviously this campaign is very social media driven. And yes, I see everyone, you know, at the shoot every year, but just in terms of coming together as a collective community, because we really have done this as a community. So we have an event coming up this Sunday at Fed Hall from 1 to 4:30. And we've put together various activities within this event. So we've got an art gallery exhibit with images from the last 10 years. We have a vendor area that has about 20 different businesses. There's people with Down syndrome and all disabilities that have businesses that are coming to, you know, sell things and show their skills at this event as well. We've got an amazing speaker lineup. So we have Madison Tevlin coming to speak on Sunday. And we also have, I think our big project that we worked on the last year is a documentary to, you know, just basically show everyone what we did in the last 10 years in a video format. So that film will premiere this Sunday, and local filmmakers Digital Sabbath did that for us.
Oh, they do such good work there at Digital Sabbath, for sure. So that's Sunday starting at 1 at Fed Hall, the University of Waterloo. Tara, what does this mean to the Down syndrome community here in the region of Waterloo and Wellington?
Well, I think we are all just so thankful to Hillary for her passion and her love for our community. And, you know, for all of us to be able to come together on Sunday and celebrate this incredible process that we've gone through over the past 10 years of telling the world about our lives, right? As a parent of a child with Down syndrome, you know, it's a beautiful thing to be able to have this platform to be able to answer questions that people ask, or to be able to share things about our lives that, you know, our lives are better because of our child with Down syndrome, and to kind of shift perspectives of people so that hopefully the broader community will be able to, you know, see value in people with Down syndrome, and hopefully that will lead to more volunteer and job opportunities and more opportunities for people with Down syndrome to be included in community programming and, you know, just even friendships and just acceptance, I guess, right?
Is the public able to join you at this event on Sunday at Fed Hall?
They are, yes. We have just a few tickets left. We're looking at close to 600 people that'll be attending this event. So they can still find the link on Eventbrite under Decade, but there really are only a few tickets left. But they can also do, see it by live stream, and we'll be posting a link to that soon.
All right. Eventbrite, search Decade, few tickets left. 600 is an amazing number. Great venue at Fed Hall. That's going to be a perfect fit for it. But if anybody is still interested, perhaps you can snag one of those remaining tickets, because this is important. Hillary, when you think back on a decade of doing this, and arguably, I mean, being a catalyst for these conversations in our community, how does that make you feel?
Well, I always like to, you know, swing it back to our members and swing it back to the people that we're doing this for. And I think, you know, the portraits themselves truly just were an invitation to the conversation. I think that's what I've really learned over the years, it's when I asked myself, like, what is it about these portraits that are causing so much conversation? But I think it's just, we began to see people with Down syndrome in a light that we hadn't in the past. And again, like the imagery that existed 10 years ago, there wasn't a lot. And what was out there just was not representative of the community. So I think that, you know, the impact of these portraits, and I've always believed in the power of a photograph, I think it just really reinforces how much to this day, how important photographs are and how we represent people matters in media.
I enjoy my calendar every year. They are beautiful photographs, and they absolutely capture, I think, what it is you've been capturing for the past decade now. Kudos on the success, and I hope Sunday's just a terrific event for you. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Tara Hart and Hilary Gauld joining us on the show. Hilary is the photographer behind the decade, what has now been a decade series of photographs, an annual calendar in support of the Waterloo-Wellington Down Syndrome Society. Tara is a board member with the society and parent of a child with Down syndrome. It really is terrific stuff. Watch for the calendar when it comes around annually, and they will mark Down Syndrome Awareness Week in Canada beginning Sunday with their event at Fed Hall, which starts at 1. If you check out Eventbrite and you search Decade, that's the name of their event, then you'll maybe be able to snag one of those remaining tickets. But terrific work and a great celebration of the 10-year journey to date. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, I made mention of this on the show earlier today about what it is Ontario's big city mayors want, particularly from the provincial government. Legislative change, maybe even invoking a notwithstanding clause so that involuntary treatment becomes an option for communities that are struggling with homelessness and addiction. We'll share some of the conversation around that big city mayor's meeting from last week coming up on the Mike Farwell Show. Stay with us. This is 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. I want to take you back to something I mentioned near the beginning of the show, because Cambridge Mayor Jan Liggett appeared on TVO's The Agenda the other night following a meeting last week of the Ontario Big City Mayors Caucus. So that group includes the mayors of our three cities here in the region, Kitchener, Cambridge, Waterloo, Guelph, Oshawa, Kingston, London. I mean, I could go on with the, there are 400 plus municipalities in Ontario, but many earn the distinction of big cities. And so the mayors of those cities meet on a regular basis to discuss ideas, to advocate. And a motion that was brought forward to that meeting of big city mayors last week called for, and I quote, a system of mandatory community-based and residential mental health and addictions treatment facilities, and further went on to suggest that the provincial and federal governments invoke the notwithstanding clause to prevent likely constitutional challenges while ensuring that individuals are able to access treatment if they are in need. Eventually, through the meeting, the mayors agreed on a softened version of that. But the idea is clear here. Municipal mayors in Ontario's big cities are saying, we're struggling with homelessness and addiction. Not only do we need more support from the provincial government, but we need legislative change that gives us a greater ability to act in the best interests of community and maybe even in the best interests of individuals who do not act in their own best interests. It gets pretty complicated, but I want to share with you, and it gets pretty polarizing as well, but I want to share with you a bit of an exchange between the mayor of Oshawa, Dan Carter, and our mayor of Cambridge, Jan Liggett, around this very idea.
I urge the provincial and federal government to get uncomfortable, to take on this challenge and say, the reason why we're doing this is because of the reason that we want to save your child's life. Do you know 46,000 people have died with drug poisoning since 2016 across this country. We continue to see people die on our streets. We can't sit by and continue to do what we've been doing and say, well, we'll get there someday. Someday is today. It has to change today. It's worth the fight, and I think it's worth the challenge itself. I think it'll bring it as a national conversation that absolutely needs to be to happen. So do I encourage the provincial and federal government to take the appropriate steps? Absolutely, and I want to see it done immediately.
We must remember that when the Charter of Rights was brought in, we didn't have this crisis. It didn't exist. Right. So now we're looking at mental health problems where people have psychotic episodes and hurt people badly on the street. We have entire generation of people who are addicted and may never come out of that addiction. We may have to look after them for the rest of their lives, but that number keeps growing over and over and over again. And I'm sure If the writers of the Charter of Rights could have foreseen this, they would have put some caveat in there in order to protect us today. But it's not there. So that means we have to pick up the next stage of that. And so there's some of us here today, maybe all of us here today, who would like to see the notwithstanding clause used. And I'm one of them. It didn't pass through the big city mayors. We had a conversation about it. Not everybody was on board, and we didn't want to push that. But that doesn't mean we haven't opened the door for it. It doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to press for that in maybe another way. But I personally strongly believe, and I'm being a leader of my community and representing the people of my community, I want to see it used. And I'll bet you the majority of mayors in this province would as well.
Cambridge Mayor Jan Leggett, who would be open to the idea of invoking the notwithstanding clause so that those who are unwilling or unable to access treatment on their own can be essentially forced into it. Mayor Leggett believes that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms never envisioned 40 years ago upon its creation the situation that we find ourselves in today. But that is the big issue. The charter challenges that result when you try to involuntarily, that's the softer word we use, move people into treatment. But as Dan Carter, the mayor of Oshawa, said in that clip you just heard, he thinks the time is now for the federal and provincial governments to get uncomfortable and open this national conversation about how we deal with what is an issue that seems only to be growing. That's a little bit from what the big city mayors talked about last week. We'll try to get it onto our show for a conversation at some point still this week. This is the Mike Farwell Show on 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. I love to read, but I don't read as much for pleasure today as I once did. I used to sit down and take in an entire Hardy Boys book in a night when I was a wee lad. Anyway, the point of this is that I still do read. You're welcome. I feel like that's a good thing to do, right? But a lot of it is work-related, to find ideas for the show, to keep up with what's going on. And something that I read the other day, it spoke so directly to me that I thought, well, we've just got to bring this to the show for a conversation, because I have been convinced over the last many years that younger people struggle to get into the housing market for a variety of reasons, none of which include their fondness for avocado toast and extra large coffees at fancy coffee shops, right? Do you remember that? That was the whole thing. All those millennials and their avocado toast. That's why their financial dreams have been shattered. But they respond, no, 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 it's not that. And even if you take out the avocado toast, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know me. I am as parsimonious, aka cheap, as the day is long. I have never met a couple of nickels that I didn't want to rub together. I love me some frugality. And so I make relatively careful choices around where my hard-earned money gets spent. And so I read this article about the pumpkin spice latte factor. And I thought, wait a minute, nobody's talking about this anymore. That's like saying it's the avocado toast that's keeping the millennials from getting into the housing market. Well, when you do the math, as my dear friend St. Catherine's beer guy would say,
do the math,
you find out that the pumpkin spice latte is really adding up. And if you put the money you spent on the latte somewhere else, all the riches you would have. It's not just my idea. It's the idea of our next guest. And you'll hear from her coming up on the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio. And my opinion in this particular case would be, yes, it is more difficult today than it was for me to get into the housing market when I did, when I was a younger person. More difficult, yes. Not impossible by any stretch. And if one finds those nickels that I like to find and rub them together, you might find that you can get there if you manage your money properly or by using principles that we have long understood when it comes to budgeting. Leslie Ann Scorgi is the founder of MeVest and joins us for a conversation this morning. Leslie Ann, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
You were enjoying a pumpkin spice latte the other day, and all of a sudden the light bulb went off. You big spender, you, Leslie Ann.
Right. Did the light bulb go off, or did the overpriced cinnamon, clove, nutmeg flavor just make my eyes bulge out of my head? You know, I think the thing is, what was so shocking is the latte cost me $10. So, of course, I enjoyed every minute of it. And I sipped it slow and had a smile on my face the entire time. However, I will not be buying another one probably until December. And probably, honestly, only if somebody gives me a gift card.
Leslie Ann, you and me are so much alike. I think we just became best friends.
There we go.
And to be clear here, there is absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying a pumpkin spice latte or two. It's really the frequency with which we enjoy that treat that becomes a problem with our budgets, right?
You got it. And I think back to one of the first personal finance books I ever read. It was called Automatic Millionaire. I think it came out in 2003, and the author, David Bach, introduced this idea of the latte factor. Like, if only he had known him his scenario, he, like, modeled it under a $5 latte scenario. Like, dude, it's $10 now. You know, his concept, though, was really simple. Like, if you maybe didn't have as many of those lattes and you took the savings and invested it for your future retirement, or maybe it is a home down the road, that, you know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially that you would literally be ingesting if you don't stop your habit, or at least, like, quell the habit, mix it in half, or you know, right size it to what your goals are.
Can you spell it out for us, Leslie Ann? What could this be costing us, just so we really get an idea here?
Okay, so I have a feeling you also do this, where, like, you play around with compound interest calculators.
Oh, the eighth wonder of the world. I love compound interest.
The eighth wonder of the world. So I did. And I decided I'm going to put this $10 per day latte into a compound interest calculator, and just spelled out, you know, $10 a day, 30 days in a month is $300 a month, which then works up to $3,600 a year. And over the course of, you know, your entire working career, it could add up to $600,000 if you use the average rate of return in the market, which is remarkable, right? Like, it's so much money. But, you know, I think this is the part where I certainly get asked, but who are those people? Like, who is actually spending $10 a day? My response is, like, look around, right? It's micro purchases everywhere we go. It could be the latte for somebody. It could be
I don't know, like scrolling that night on Amazon, and it seems like $10 here, $7 there won't add up. But it's those like smaller micro purchases that you could compare to this or the pumpkin spice latte factor. I should rename it. which I did try, by the way. It's really that latte factor that adds up. And just imagine you took that $10 a day and you didn't buy the latte. You didn't buy that, like, I don't know, door hanger for Christmas that, you know, you ordered on Amazon. And instead you put that $10 a day away and you did it for 30 years. Like, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then, you know, another version of this is maybe you only have one latte a week, or in my case, like one latte a quarter at this day. And you socked away the rest of it in, you know, I would say like a balanced growth portfolio. You could end up quite literally like with your retirement nest egg right there in front of you.
I love the image of Leslie Ann's quarterly reports that include a budget line item for one pumpkin spice latte.
One latte.
So good. So good. Okay. So what is it, do you suppose, or how is it, do you suppose, that we've sort of distanced ourselves from this really basic fundamental budgeting principle?
So, you know, I've written about this recently, actually, in this, it's called like disassociation. And in this crazy world with extremely high cost of living that we are in right now, a lot of people are finding relief, and joy in these tiny expenses. So they consider it tiny, like it's just a latte. It's just, I don't know, fill in the blank, a chocolate bar. It's just another egg sandwich elsewhere. And I think what's happening is we have stress, anxiety. We've kind of disassociated with what our budgets actually are saying to us. And I call it, in my work, we call it like autopilot mode, where so many people are not really present as they're maybe not even making a budget, right? You might be listening to this going, oh, does that mean I need to have a budget? The answer is, yeah, it would really help. You know, and one of the prescriptions that we kind of give out to people who are struggling with this autopilot mode, which BT dubs, often ends up in piles of debt or in so many lattes that thousands of dollars go out the door. You know, we often say that one of the best ways to kind of get on track and reassociate yourself with this principle of saving for the future is to budget, and is to include in that budget the occasional joy, the occasional splurge. But that's, for the most part, it is anchored on the idea that you can save for the future and still balance having a few treats today. So, like, we're human, and it is good. It is very good to have treats in your budget. So we don't want to do this whole deprivation strategy, you know, like people do with yo-yo diets. We don't want that. We want this budgeting process to feel like it has the occasional pumpkin spice latte in there, and that it has the occasional, you know, pure joy treat, but that it is not compromising retirement savings.
Excellent advice, and I'm so glad we could have this conversation today. Leslie Ann, thanks for inspiring it, and I hope we can talk again.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mike.
All right, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Leslie Ann Scorgi is the founder of MeVest. And you know what? So here's the thing. That deprivation idea that Leslie Ann just alluded to, I'm going to be honest with you. I might be the king of deprivation. I can so easily put it off, defer it until whenever. And my beloved has done a great job reminding me that, hey, you only get to go around this crazy life thing one time. And you never know when your time with this crazy life thing is up. So I try to incorporate more. And I'm not talking to the big choice. I'm just talking the simple little things, right? And I think I've got them. Some of them. I'm still a work in progress in that regard. But I heard this, and when Leslie Ann mentioned this idea of deprivation, or, you know, making sure that you still have some of those treats in your budget, which, yes, you should create. Thank you very much. Goodness gracious me. They're still teaching this in school, right? But the thing is, and I heard this in another radio conversation the other day, not connected to this story, but the idea was, and what the host was talking about, was the inability for young people to save a home. That's or save for a home. That's the big lament today. Oh, we can't do it. It's too hard, this and that. But then, and she described a nephew at a family dinner, but he's still taking his vacations. He's leasing this vehicle, all of these other things. But oh no, he can't save for a home. Because this radio host's belief was that we are dealing with or speaking to a generation that is not accustomed to hearing the word no, right? Everything that you want, you get to have. As opposed to, well, I mean, I guess you could have this, but do you want a house someday down the road? Then maybe you want to dial back the lattes to one per quarter. Does any of this resonate with you? Like, surely I'm not the only one who measures the number of times you put that joy into your budget, right? These principles, these are foundational budgeting principles. Have we just forgotten all about them? If you've got a tip or a trick that you'd like to share, I am all ears, because if I can find another way to rub two nickels together, gosh darn it, you're going to make my day. This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV.
$10 a day, 30 days in a month is $300 a month, which then works up to $3,600 a year. And over the course of, you know, your entire working career, it could add up to $600,000 if you use the average rate of return in the market, which is remarkable.
Compound interest, baby. It's the eighth wonder of the world. That is Leslie Ann Scorgi, who's the founder of MeVest. And she wrote a piece the other day as she enjoyed her quarterly treat. She buys them about once every 3 months, a pumpkin spice latte. And then she did, in the immortal words of my favorite St. Catharines beer store guy,
do the math.
She did the math. And it turns out that over the course of a working lifetime, you could buy a $10 pumpkin spice latte every day, or you could invest that $10 instead, and you'd have more than $600,000 when you retire. These are very simple budgeting principles, and I feel as though we have gotten further and further away from them. And I blame it in part on what I call the click, click, spend era. And this popped into my head last night. I knew we were going to be talking about this on the show, and a commercial came on during the hockey game for Uber Eats. I'm not trying to, like, good for you, solving a problem that we didn't know we had, Uber Eats people, but it was a commercial that advertised fast food, which we know eating out impacts our monthly budgets. And on top of the eating out part, it's like, yeah, we'll just use the app to get the food delivered right to your door. Click, click, spend. And Leslie Ann referred to that in our conversation as well. It could be the pumpkin spice latte factor, or it could be just idly scrolling Amazon, you know, while you're a little bit bored. And, oh yeah, I need this thing. I need that thing. Click, click, spend. It shows up on your porch. I don't believe we have the same connection. And it's probably in part because money is plastic now, right? It's a debit card. It's not actual cash. We don't go to the bank and handle cash. We can put the debit card or credit card on our phone. Like, it's just, it, you store your information. It is so easy to part you and your money. Lynn sends an email to Mike at 570news.com. I read David Bach's book, and I've even given them to my working grandkids as gifts. It's common sense advice. I believe that this common sense information to save money should be taught in school. I think that's part of the financial literacy curriculum. I hope it is. This is basic stuff. And I really think we would go a long way towards alleviating some financial concerns for younger people if we drilled this stuff into their heads today. But that's just this old guy talking. Let's go to the phones. Mary is with us. Good morning, Mary.
Oh, hi, Mike.
Hi.
Oh, I'm as cheap as you are.
Are you sure? Like, I'll have a competition with you on cheapness.
I think I'm even cheaper.
No way, Mary. Nobody's cheaper than me. You ask my beloved. She'll tell you.
I don't, well, you know, when you're when you were growing up and there wasn't much money, and then my children and that, and certain circumstances, wondering where the next meal's coming from. And of course, you clip the coupons, you do this and that, and you know, my kids used to be mad at me. Oh, listen, you try and make the milk go farther with the whatever, the dried milk, and oh, Mom, you put that in there. We don't like it. Okay. And, you know, it just, and I think I agree that the young people today want too much instant gratification.
Exactly, yes. And then we just allow it, though. It's yes, yes, every time.
Well, I don't allow it. They're not with me. I try and help them, but sometimes they don't want to let me help them. And what else was I going to say? Okay. The wealthy barber.
Oh, good old David Chilton. I love that guy.
Yeah, I love him too. Okay, so I'm done with that. But quickly, I was on a short trip out in the city yesterday, not the Iron Needles, and I can't believe how many jack wagons are on the road.
Mary.
And I have to tell you, Mike, that's a gentler, kinder word than I was using.
Bless your heart for using a gentler, kinder word. Do you know how many jack wagons are on the road, Mary? All of them. That's the answer. Yes.
Yeah,
all right.
What's wrong with them?
What's wrong with them?
We're perfect.
Come on with your coming on.
Perfect.
I know we are.
Come on.
All right, Mary, you go back to New Hamburg. Have a good day. That went in a slightly different direction at the end. Did you notice, though, how Mary said she tries to help out and the kids sometimes won't let her? She can help out because she was smart with her money when she was younger. Like, shouldn't that be the goal? To have enough of it that you no longer worry a little bit later. I don't know. Anyway, I really think that we have lost the plot on some of these foundational principles. And I'm glad there are people like Leslie Ann around who will write about them from time to time, who will join us on the show to talk about them, just to remind us that you could buy that pumpkin spice latte every day. Or even, like, I'm not trying to knock the coffee chains, but you could go to that drive-thru at the big coffee chain too. And it's $2.50 here and it's $2.50 there. And the next thing you know, you could have had a resort vacation in the wintertime. Instead, you dropped it on coffee. This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. Only 1 minute until our news update, but you know me. Always time for one more, right? Joanna, good morning.
Hey, thanks for saving the best for last. Well, I'm right to the point.
Okay.
So, financial literacy, most people are financially literate, not blaming anyone, just saying it's normative in our culture. And I think there's a lack of casting the vision for building wealth in just all over the board. And so I would just say the biggest thing that impacted me growing up is my mom and dad cast the vision for how to build wealth and how to create something that lasts, taught us how to save, how to give, how to spend from the time we were little. And we have done that with our kids, and I'm so proud of my older two kids. I got six kids, but two that run their own businesses. They're 20 and 19. They save thousands because we made them save their money in high school. Remember, a teenager's brain is not fully developed, and sometimes you do things that they hate at the time, but gosh, they love us now. So now instead of having all these useless items like their friends, they have thousands of dollars ready to buy a house, and I think it starts at home. And if you can kind of catch that vision and teach your kids, it will spread. And I think that would be something that would be great to have incorporated. I know when I went to school, there was nothing on building wealth and financial literacy, how to run a budget, blah, blah, blah. So hopefully that's something that can change. But when we have governments that spend like drunken sailors and normalize debt, it's really hard to kind of switch that thinking when that's the example for the youth. It's terrible.
Joanna, you're so right. And I'm so sorry because I'm way late for news now. I was thinking of the government example, too. I'm so glad you brought that up. I hope you call again because I want to talk to you about six kids. Holy Hannah. This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. They are called Culture Talks, and they bring together all of the right people to talk about all of the right things. And they are led through our Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery. Shirley Medill is the executive director there and joins us in studio. Shirley, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And along with Shirley, Craig Beatty is here, who's the CEO and founding partner with Perimeter Development. Good to see you, Craig. Good morning.
Good to see you, too.
Shirley, let's start with you, if we could, please. Culture Talks. Where did the idea of these events come from?
It goes back as far as 2018, and it was a conversation that I had with Perimeter Development about coming into partnership, because we were the whole region is in this whole process of culture plans and talks. But I came in with the thematic creating culturally active spaces. And the reason I did was that we truly believe at the gallery that we play a very serious role in civic engagement. And with civic engagement, culture is very much a part of the whole building and city transformation process. In other words, art plays a critical role in a revitalization of a city. So always good to have cultural workers at the same table as the urban planners and the developers. And Perimeter Development Corporation came on board. And from there, we had four speakers, and it then grew into other themes such as art, architecture, and environment, followed by placemaking. So we were looking at public art projects. How do you expand social cohesion in spaces? And now we're right into the public realm. And that's the big picture of visioning.
So who is at the table at a culture talk?
Who is at the table in terms of audiences, or, you know, in terms of speakers?
In terms of speakers, yeah.
We usually bring in designers, you know, for example, urban designers. Ken Greenberg was in, for example, architects. But very specifically, those speakers and firms that are really doing major projects that look into, you know, this changing demographic that's happening, social cohesion, looking at those gaps in spaces and cities. So these are the speakers, and they do range from architects, designers, and, you know, at times urban planners.
Right. I love the whole idea and those intersectionalities that happen with it. And Craig, from your perspective with Perimeter Development, I mean, what's the interest? Aren't you just supposed to be putting up buildings and making money? Like, isn't that, are you missing your mission statement here?
No, listen, to us, it's, you know, we like to think of ourselves as sort of community city builders, and, you know, obviously physical buildings and new construction, new projects are part of that. But, you know, us playing a role in helping some of these other components to, you know, add to the well-being of the city and the community has been really important for us for many, many years. And I think we were really drawn to this initiative by Shirley and the KWAG folks, because we really think it's important to have these conversations. I mean, this is a growing community. Everybody likes to talk about, you know, we're growing to a million people, we're growing, and it's, you got to think of all of these things, and what do we need to be doing differently and thinking bigger. And I think, you know, kudos to Shirley and her crew. I mean, some of the speakers and the folks who have come for some of the past culture talks are really phenomenally talented people that have done work around the world. And, you know, it's a great opportunity for us in this community to, you know, just hear and take some learnings from some of the things these folks have done, you know, in other markets. And, you know, not that, hey, we can necessarily replicate things that have been done elsewhere, but there's just great ideas everywhere, and it's important to think broadly.
When you think about what makes a place interesting or appealing, what do you think about?
Well, it's just, it's really about mix, you know. It's just about vibrancy, and it's about a variety of things available for, you know, for people to do, see, entertainment, dining, retail, you name it, events. It's all of the above.
Sometimes I think, Craig, or I worry that in order to get these interesting things done, there are gatekeepers, let's say, that are bound by legislation or bound by different kinds of ideas. Is it difficult to bring forward a vision and see it through to realization?
I would say it's we're seeing it becoming more challenging. Like, I think there does seem to be not as much big picture aspirational visioning thinking happening, and it's there's just a lot of very much, you know, just looking very short-sightedness, and I think we just need to get back to a little more big picture, aspirational thinking, and let's do some dream up some big things to do.
Shirley, let's come back to the audience piece of these culture talks. We yes. talked about the speakers earlier and really the why behind them, but who's in the audience and what do they gain from these experiences?
It's a really great question because the audience is very diverse in terms of background. So we have artists in the audience. We've had the cultural workers at the at our cities, you know, for example. Urban planners have attended. And I think also cultural workers, curators, you know, are also in the audience. So it's been really very varied. The response that we get is tremendous. They hope that we continue these talks. And many have come in with suggestions, for example, you know, because, you know, when we're in the public realm and we're trying to, you know, fill those gaps now, right? If you're doing a whole visioning exercise that we're doing, let's say, in the city of Kitchener and there's heritage buildings, we're sort of paying attention to also what our audiences are asking for. And also what I'm hearing, you know, from, I guess, from outside, you know, for those involved in the cities.
I loved what you said at the outset, Shirley, around the importance and the central role that arts plays in all of this. And obviously, through your lens as the executive director at KWAG, that would make some sense. But I feel like we're at a really interesting place of late when it comes to the role of arts in a community. How would you describe that role of today?
That role is that it's often forgotten that artists and cultural workers do have an aesthetic, right? They have an aesthetic view and they also see things differently. So it's in a way setting things outside one's comfort zone. And in many cities, I think particularly in Europe, this happens, is that they do sit at the same table. They get an artist or cultural worker sitting at the same table because they will see something that maybe others in that box, let's say the urban planning box or, you know, whatever box that they're looking at. Even architects, you know, look at artists and cultural workers to work with them in their buildings. And what happens is an interesting discussion. I mean, one city that has done it is St. Catharines, was sitting at the table with a group of urban planners who maybe at first thought, this is a little strange, but in the end, it did make an impact on how a bridge would look.
Craig, we are a growing community, a rapidly growing community, heading towards a million people in the next couple decades. Is there opportunity here for us as a region to be this interesting and vibrant place through the built form?
Yeah, absolutely there is. And I think it goes back to, that's why it's so important to be having these conversations now, and it's developing some roadmaps and identifying some big major aspirational things that we want to accomplish, because none of these things happen overnight or in a year, 2 years. Some of these big things take 5-10 years to accomplish, and you know, you just can't wake up one day and all of a sudden we're a million people and you snap your fingers and we get, you know, X, Y, and Z done. So that's why these talks are important. And again, we you know, I think it's just trying to keep the momentum going about like hearing some of these great, you know, speakers on some great ideas and great things that they've done. It's like, hey, that doesn't just need to be elsewhere. Like, we can do those things here. And it comes back to, hey, we need that leadership to say, hey, let's get after it here and let's start to make these things happen.
I like that idea of those aspirational goals for sure. We're having this conversation today, Shirley, with intent, because our next Culture Talk opportunity is only over 24 hours away. It's happening tomorrow.
That's right. It's happening tomorrow night. The talk starts at 6:30, and it's Era Architects. So we're bringing in Scott Weir and Andrew Pruss. And Andrew actually was a former graduate at the School of Architecture at the University of Waterloo. And their specialty actually is in heritage buildings. And given that the city of Kitchener owns a lot of heritage buildings, and many are being, you know, transformed, as we just noted, including the Walpole Hotel. So they're going to be, we're going to be looking at those possibilities. So 6:30 tomorrow and at the Walpole Hotel.
At the Walpole, thank you. And do we need tickets to get there?
$20. You can register online or you can come to the door.
All right. Walpole tomorrow night, 6:30 for the next Culture Talk. And I hope you get the sense of what that's all about from this conversation today. Shirley Medill, the executive director at the KW Art Gallery, Craig Beattie, CEO, founding partner, Perimeter Development, Thank you both very much for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. It is a big week for the Inshallah Community Choir. New songbook, concert to celebrate the publication of that songbook, and our opportunity to learn more about it with the founder of the choir itself and also the director of the Kanata Center for Worship and Global Song at Martin Luther University College. Debbie Lou Ludolph joins us this morning. Debbie Lou, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mike. So glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. It was great to just randomly run into you in person at Martin Luther University College last week.
I know. It's true. Thanks for being here.
Oh, yeah. Happy to be. It was a great opportunity to spend some time with our best and brightest young people. That was a lot of fun. But to the matter at hand, let's talk first about the choir itself, how it got started and what the community choir and Inshallah really is all about.
Thanks. Inshallah is an Arabic word that means God willing, and it came out of a study trip that Luther took to Israel and Palestine in 2007. I was on that trip, and the short story is folks there said, go home and sing our songs as a way to tell our story. So that's 2007. And I thought, I had a music degree. I was working a little bit at the seminary at the time. Thought, I think I could do that. And at the same time, a lot of communities, Christian church communities, they were beginning to have songs from the Global South in their songbooks. And so the practice began to sing songs, but tell the stories behind the songs when you're singing them. So you learn more about the people, which then means you learn more about people who are right here in Waterloo region from those locations, right? And so that really formed and shaped who Inshallah was. We started with 20. There's about 150 that sing with us now, and it kind of survived. Didn't know if it would survive through COVID, but we kept things going online. And the practice is really song and story towards the common good, you know? And that's where we started.
What a powerful way, though, to share those stories and tell those stories through song, right?
It's true. It is true. And there's people here right in this region who can more authentically tell that story than my background. I have a particular background. But so we really work hard to have people who know that story firsthand or to read from the places that can tell that story firsthand. So, we unlearn some stories, too. For 8 years, we sang together with the drumming circle here in the region. And that was really transformative for the choir, right? The Indigenous settler relations. We're very gifted by people who walked into the choir. So it very much started as a Lutheran Christian group, people who've been on this study trip, 20 people, and then people started to walk in from all religious and cultural backgrounds. And so it's really expanded. Yeah, we've all learned from that.
Are there criteria, Debbie Lou, that must be met for someone to participate in the choir?
You can come. No, you can come. Anybody's welcome. And we always have 2 or 3 weeks at the beginning of a season to say, come, try it out, see if it's for you. It used to be called a choir practice. It's now called a singing community because people found it was just a way to strengthen their way of being in the world, to pause for an hour and a half and sing songs and listen to the stories. And so anybody is welcome. There's no audition. Just come.
Tell us, please, about the new songbook that's just been published.
Sure. It's our second songbook. The first songbook was called Sing the Circle Wide, and it was really to gather up the stories from the first 10 years of the communities and stories that we had been singing from, and to put those together. A little bit it was dealing with copyright. Let's put them all in one book. And then this celebrates the last 8 years. And so it's called Sing the Journey Deep. First one was Sing the Circle Wide. This is Sing the Journey Deep. The title, crediting my colleague Alan Jorgensen, came up with the title, but it really does reflect what we want to do. We're going to sing what's going on in our journey right now, and we're going to go deep deep meaning, like really particular, learn about the religious or cultural backgrounds of the songs, and then go farther deep to find our common humanity and how we can work together for good. So an example would be the Middle East. I mean, that's where our beginnings came from. We haven't forgotten that. And we sing songs from Lebanon and Palestine in Arabic, and we sing songs in Hebrew so that we can hold the humanity of the other as we, you know, pray for peace in the Middle East. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, Debbie Lou, that when it comes to participation in the choir, we can just show up. There's no audition, just bring our enthusiasm for song. Is that kind of the idea with the public sing-along tomorrow evening?
Great question. Thank you for that. It is. It is. And we have the Menno singers are coming. The age majority singers are coming. Who else? The teachers choir is coming, and their director, Jane Schultz Jansen, is helping to facilitate that night. And inshallah, we'll be there. So church choirs have canceled some of their rehearsals so they could bring their whole choir. Anybody can come. $10 at the door. If you haven't registered, you can register. But if you haven't registered, $10 at the door. And the featured person is Mark Miller. And the reason he's coming to help us celebrate this is for the last 8 years when I've asked singers at the end of the term, you know, what are your favorite songs to sing? His songs always come to the top of the list. The three that are in our book, one is We Need a Revolution of the Heart. It's a quote from Dorothy Day, who's a social activist. Second one is I Choose Love in the Midst of Pain. I Choose Love in the Midst of War. I Choose Peace. And the third one is We Resist. We resist. We refuse to let hatred reign. We rise up. We won't. I forget what the end of that is. But anyway, we're gonna sing together, pray for our enemies, show love to our neighbor. So those are his songs. And the choir finds him very powerful to sing regularly. So he's coming. And he's a well-known composer, educator. He teaches at Yale and at Drew University in the States. He's a Juilliard graduate. So the night will be a great big community sing. And anybody who loves to sing is welcome to come, and it will be singing his songs. And he's a beautiful man. I've met him before, and he'll tell stories and lead us in song.
It sounds incredible. And, you know, you list off the teacher's choir, age of majority singers, Menno singers, who have all been at different times on this show, which we're so happy to have the chance to profile. Now we can add Inshallah to that, which is lovely. And you mentioned tickets, $10 at the door. Which door are we at?
Good. The St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, St. Matthew's Center, now it's being called. And, 7:30.
7:30, St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, or St. Matthew's Center, you said we're calling it. Okay, there we go. Mm-hmm. Debbie Lou, I love what you're doing. I think it's great, and I'm so glad we could have this conversation today. Thank you for being here.
Can I tell you about one more event real quick?
Absolutely.
Which is Friday night at Trillium Lutheran Church, Inshallah and Mark Miller singing. So it's a big night to celebrate the book itself. So come on out. That's free will donation. Just come 7:30 Friday night at Trillium.
I'm so glad you said that, because when you mentioned Mark, I didn't know Mark was going to be part of the sing-along tomorrow. So I'm glad.
Yeah.
Thank you. I made poor notes. So the sing-along tomorrow, Mark will participate. And then Friday night, you're singing with. So St. Matthew's Center tomorrow. And Trillium United on Friday night.
Trillium Lutheran?
Trillium Lutheran.
On Friday night.
Thank you.
both 7:30.
All right. We're all set. Debbie Lou, thank you so much. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, Mike. Bye.
Bye-bye. Debbie Lou Ludolph is the founder of the Inshallah Community Choir, joining us on the Mike Farwell Show. 570 News Radio and Rogers TV. I cannot tell a lie. I'm pooped. So do me a favor, okay? Like the great person that you are. Help me out. The next hour, we're going to open up the phone lines. You can start the conversation. I'll think less, listen more, and we'll have a good old chin wag together, okay? Your 12 o'clock talk back hour is coming up right after this update from the 570 News Center on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio, and so long to our friends at Rogers TV for another day.
Take out the papers and the trash, or you don't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more.
Don't
Don't talk back.
Just finish cleaning up your room. Let's see that dust fly with that broom. Get all that garbage out of sight. Or you don't go out Friday night. Yaggedy yak.
Don't talk back.
I am currently having my breakfast for lunch. I just got around during Matt's noon update to opening my yogurt and beginning to consume some of it. It's been a busy show for busy people today. I love it. This is the hour now that is here for you. Something that we talked about on the show you want to respond to. A completely different idea you want to lay down for us to consider. Whatever it is, phone lines open. The 12 o'clock talk back hour begins. And we start with Sean, who has been waiting patiently to be first on the Talkback Hour today. Good afternoon, Sean.
Thanks, Mike. I'm just waiting because I have an appointment at 12:10, and this was the only time I could call. Settle into that yogurt because I'm going to yakety-yak for just a second. Your 10 o'clock segment was about media literacy and the potential for misinformation and disinformation. At the end of that segment, you took a call from a caller named Jonathan who talked about the Rangers releasing an Antonino Pugliese thank you post, and he was confused by that. And when he commented on it, people came back at him. I just want to clarify that story because I was one of the people that responded to Jonathan. So when Jonathan said on your show, I was confused by the post, what he actually said in the post was, I'm confused by this post. What's the team trying to hide? Why aren't they saying whether he was released? Why are they concealing information? There was a lot of accusations in there. And then myself and others pointed out there's nothing concealed. The press release has already been released. You can find it on the website. You can find it in the email press release if you got it. It's on the Facebook page. It was on Twitter. It just didn't happen to be on Instagram. And anytime somebody pointed that out, Jonathan shot back and doubled down that they were concealing something and they wouldn't say what had happened with Pugliese. And this went back and forth and back and forth until there was a lot of animosity amongst the parties. And so when Jonathan calls and says that, that's not accurate. And I tried to point out to him, you need to just go to the right source. You need to go where the news is to get the news, and you go to the social media to get the social media. So this dovetails into the whole point, I think, of that topic that you had, Mike, and I missed the first portion, so I apologize if I'm not landing on it correctly. But just because you can't find something or don't know where to find something or are unwilling to take 30 seconds to Google and find something doesn't mean you can just label it as nefarious or sinister because it's not in the way you want to receive it or in the place you think it should be. News is news, social is social, but you can't just come in guns a-blazing, super aggressive about something with accusations, and then when people say, oh no, that's not the case, then say, wait a minute, everybody's being super aggressive with me. That's just not accurate. And that's more misinformation than the post itself. So I just wanted to put my two cents in on that.
All right, Sean, appreciate that and appreciate you listening to the show and picking up things from different parts of the day. We do 4 hours and I never expect you to listen to all four. I love it if you do, though, even if you just have some background and then something, you know, perks up your ears or whatever the case may be. And I think the information and topics are diverse enough to, you know, keep you engaged from 9 until 1 every day. I certainly hope so. To that point, let me say this. First of all, what I said to Jonathan at the time when he called in and expressed his concern about that is that no private organization, and community-owned or not, that's what the Kitchener Rangers are, if we're going to use that specific example, they don't owe you anything other than what they want to say. They're not accountable. I mean, I guess you could argue as fans, they're accountable to you, but it's a public entity like a school board, which we had some conversations about today. They are accountable directly to the public that elects them and that funds them 100% across the board. If a private organization or company wanted to issue a statement that says, our CEO, Mike Farwell, is no longer with us. We wish him the best of luck in his future endeavors. That's all the private organization owes you. They don't owe you any further explanation than that at all. Period. End of story. Again, sticking specifically with this, I will also add, I know Jonathan. a little bit. And I don't think there is a mean or an unkind bone in that young man's body. So my guess, and this is what I always try to do, I always try to put myself in the shoes of the other, meet them where they're at. So my guess is that Jonathan was a pretty big fan of Antonino Pugliese and was really disheartened to learn that he had been released by the Kitchener Rangers. And so with that context being absent on social media, maybe we're better off not engaging or assuming our own context and projecting it onto the individual who made the original post. I think that generally speaking, organizations as big as the Kitchener Rangers, for example, can handle some criticism or brush off somebody that may not fully understand and is upset about something. I don't know. Like, do we really need to turn it into a social media spat? I remember way back when Instagram was first beginning to make headway as a platform, and somebody said they like it so much more than Facebook because you get all the pretty pictures without the fighting. And so now it sounds like we've resorted to doing the online arguing on Instagram too, and context is everything, and maybe, just maybe, we can all take a breath and try to meet the individual, in this case the original commenter, where they're at. And if you know Jonathan, you know there is not a mean bone in the young man's body. That's my 10 cents on it. It's a wild world, though, when we're talking about media literacy, and in the eyes of some, the media as an entity includes the social media feed of a hockey team, which is not even close to the media. And yet, I guess that's the news audience that somebody who does what I do competes with. We'll continue our talk back hour with Mayor Jake. Good afternoon, Your Worship.
Mike, how are you now?
I'm good, and you?
Good.
Good.
So there's a rumor going around.
Oh, gosh. Let me hear it, buddy. Let me go. Let's go.
I can't confirm or deny, but there is a rumor that apparently I am, or the show Shoresy, or the character Shoresy, is based off of me. Now, the reason why I say this is because I've had old teammates message me saying, "Oh, this guy Shoresy kind of sounds like you when you're playing hockey."
Well, and you know what?
He's agitating.
Yeah. And you start with, "How are you now?" That's where I learned it. Yeah.
But I've been saying that since I was a kid.
Well, so is Shoresy, though.
The show is Shoresy. So the funny thing is I've had more sticks driven between my legs than a popsicle stick. And people, before I was Mayor Jake, I was Jake the Agitator, because I'd always agitate my opponent, get him to draw a penalty on me. But that's the rumor that's been going around. Now, like I said, can't confirm or can't deny, but if it is the case, I should be having a nice conversation with Jerry Kiso, and maybe we'll settle it on the ice one day.
Mayor Jake, I want you to bring me some Shoresy-style chirps next time. Come on!
I would love to. I don't want to get in too much trouble, because sometimes my wife listens to me, and if I come home, she goes, "Why did you say that?" I'm in real trouble. But I kind of want to talk about the budgeting, when that one caller said that her six kids or her kids are doing fairly well because they were taught at a young age. You know, if they did this in schools, and I kind of talked about having basic life skills as a course in high school or for grade 13, I feel like it would go a long way. Like, wouldn't it? Like, wouldn't it be something that we could use?
100%.
Like, learning the basic budgets and learning the basic, like, prep and for food and for stuff like that, I feel like it would be useful. So that's just what I have to say on that.
All right, Shoresy. I mean, Mayor Jake, good to hear from you.
Thank you, Mike. Have a good one.
You too. You know what? He does sound a little bit like Shoresy now that you mention it. I can also neither confirm nor deny that was the one and only Shoresy. Hailing from the mean streets of Listy. Tell me it's not possible. Go ahead and tell me it's not possible. And by the way, Mayor Jake, if you think your wife sometimes wonders what the hell it was you said on the radio, you should come home after work with me someday. This is the Mike Farwell Show. It's your 12 o'clock talk back hour where we get to hear from you. 570 News Radio. Every day between noon and one, you get the space. You know what? This just popped into my head. Mayor Jake, a.k.a. Shorzy, was talking a moment ago about budgeting and what we should instill in our kids that way. Do you know, you have any idea what an hour of radio programming is worth? Financially, I mean. And I don't get started with the quality of it. I know. I bring down the value every day. I'm trying. I keep telling my boss this too. Like, honest boss. I try to uphold the value both figuratively and financially of this radio station. I do my best. Like, it's a lot of weight on these little shoulders. Anyway, it's worth a lot, and we give it to you. We give it to you every day. It's yours for free. F-R-E-E, free. One of my favorite words. So you can take full advantage. Make a call. Start a conversation here during the talk back hour. And Grant, you are next. Good afternoon. Oh, my goodness gracious, Grant. Why? Why must you always laugh at me? I feel like you're mocking me for something.
Because it's fun to make you squirm.
I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown. I amuse you. I make you laugh. I'm here to fucking amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
Yeah, thanks for explaining that detailed message about that fellow that was questioning about the Ranger player of why they didn't let people know. I actually was annoyed when at your workplace they got rid of this one individual. I'm not going to mention the guy's name, and I begged the manager to tell me exactly why. But I guess we're...
Why don't you want to mention his name, Grant? Are you afraid of him, or are you afraid of me?
No, I thought it would be good to not mention his name. I didn't want...
Okay, no, that's good. That's a sensible thing to do. But you begged management, and they wouldn't bring him back, eh?
Yeah, and I guess we're so accustomed of thinking we should know exactly why that person was let go, you know, right? Because we kind of grow up with them, and we kind of grow up with these players too, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I understand it certainly from the perspective of the job that we are given here at a radio station. We develop relationships with people. I mean, are you going to be upset when I'm gone?
Well, of course.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, that's nice. I'm glad we're going to miss one another when they finally roll my fat, tired old bones out of here.
Well, don't say that.
Well, it's going to happen. Yeah, it's okay. I'm okay with it. I'm at peace with it.
Well, we won't be.
Okay. Well, let's not worry about it right now. It's not going to happen for at least 3 weeks.
No, it's not.
No, maybe 3 years. Who knows? You just never know. Yeah.
Maybe never.
Maybe never. Wouldn't that be great? You and Grant, you and I could sit here and we could talk forever.
Well, you do make it a great show.
Thank you.
You know, even though I might annoy you, you annoy me. That's okay.
That's perfect. That right there, we should turn into a promo for the show. Even though you annoy me, I annoy you, that's okay. Because it is. We just share ideas. We come at things from different perspectives. We learn from one another. And we just keep talking. It's a beautiful thing. Your 12 o'clock talk back hour here on the Mike Farwell Show, 570 News Radio. I really don't know how I got so lucky today, but earlier when our regular caller Mayor Jake phoned in, he shared the rumor that exists that maybe, just maybe, his name isn't Jake after all. His name might be Shorzy, you know, of Letterkenny fame. And you know that the person behind the character, Jared Kiso, the actor, is from the mean streets of Listowel, as is our good friend Kyle the Skid from Listowel.
Yeah, if you walk Shoresy, there's skids, and then there's the farmers and all that.
Oh, stuff. I know, but I think they called them the Hicks, didn't they? But
or the Hicks, yeah.
But I are we allowed to say skid on the radio?
I don't know. That's,
okay,
that's a question that you'll have to answer, not me.
Too late, Kyle the Skid. Skid the kid.
I like it.
No, okay.
I was just gonna say, last week I got it. So we got a parking ticket. For illegally parking, just we went out for 2 seconds. I was moving some cars around, went inside, came out. I got a ticket, and it got me riled up because, and not the fact that I got a ticket. Yeah, sure, maybe I shouldn't have been parked there. But you were talking about it last week on the show. Why is it, and this is maybe something that you can answer, but do you realize that in the wintertime, you get a ticket a lot faster for parking when there's no snow on the ground versus in the summertime when you're illegally parked and people are saying that where's the enforcement? Like, why is it in the wintertime that you can park out in the middle of the on the street, and within 2 seconds you get a ticket, but in the summertime, like you said, somebody was parked illegally in the school zone, why can you never find somebody when you need them? Like, you notice that, Mike?
I've never noticed that tickets come more frequently in the summer, no.
No, winter.
Okay, now...
They come more frequently in the wintertime versus the summertime, because I don't really count that.
Maybe we have more bylaw officers on in the wintertime because you need to keep your car off the street so the snowplows can get through. Come on.
But what about the school zones?
Trust me.
Is that not just as important?
There is not a chance. There is not a chance in HE double hockey sticks that we have enough bylaw enforcement officers to be everywhere enforcing all of the bylaws every day, all day. So it's luck of the draw. I don't think there is any difference between the seasons.
Okay. Well, I would just maybe it's just my hypothetical scenario.
It's a great scenario. I'm all for it. Like, we can test this hypothesis all day. It's just my assumption is that it's just your bad luck.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe I should just start putting my car around certain areas. And could you imagine how many tickets I get just for? I'm just checking out to see where I can get a ticket right there. But no. All right. Cool. Thanks, Mike. That's all I want to say. Thanks, man.
All right, Kyle. Appreciate the call. You know what that makes me think of? When our radio station used to be in downtown Kitchener. I'll share that story because we used to play the parking game. It was the craziest thing. Well, not craziest thing. You do what you do to save some money. I'll get to that right after this update from the 570 News Center and more of your calls on the 12 o'clock talk back hour. This is 570 News Radio. Kyle's call earlier about parking tickets just reminded me about the days that our radio station was located in downtown Kitchener. Parking was difficult to come by. We could pay for parking at about $80 a month. This was a lot of years ago. If you're trying to park monthly downtown, I don't know what it costs you today, but back then, $80 a month. And when you're starting out, particularly in this business, it's not exactly like a high-end salary. So I'm like, I ain't paying $80 a month. That's $960 a year. So what we would do, there was a group of us that did it, because you can street park for 2 hours, but that's anywhere in the downtown core. Like, you can't just move your car to another spot and get another 2 hours. But then if you just went south of or to the other side of Joseph Street, you could have 3 hours there. So we played this game. You'd park one place for two-ish hours because you're hoping they didn't mark your tire right away or take your license plate right away. So you might have 2.5 hours or maybe even 2 hours and 45 minutes. Then you'd move your vehicle to one of the streets where there's three-hour parking and you'd leave it there. And then you've covered 5 to 6 hours of your eight-hour day and you just hoped. And you know what? I never got so many tickets that it cost me $80 a month. I might get a ticket here, a ticket there. Probably cost me $80 a quarter. Look at all the money I was saving by playing the parking game. We used to call it. I'm cheap. Have I ever mentioned that? All right, let's get back to the phones. It is your 12 o'clock talk back hour. Dylan, good afternoon.
Hey, just continuing on the parking conversation.
Sure.
I've noticed this on my street. So my street's single detached houses. A lot of people on my street have renovated the basement into an apartment. And then off of our street is a crescent of like high density townhomes. Everyone has multiple families living in their house now, and my street is lined from the stop sign off the main street all the way both sides with cars parked
because no one has room in their driveways for all these cars anymore. And I kind of feel bad for these people because come December 1st, there's no overnight parking allowed. And where these 50, 60 cars that park on our street are going to go, I have no idea. I don't understand why the city plans it this way. Everyone's about transit, but we should know by now if you can afford a car, you're going to own a car. That's just the way it is. And like I say, I have no idea what these people are going to do come December 1st.
Dylan, I appreciate that call. I'm with you. I see this happen. I see this happening in our neighborhood. There are a couple of driveways that have four vehicles in them and then more spillover onto the streets. Dylan is absolutely right. And I get the point about the planning and the desire with, I don't know what, pixie dust, that everybody's magically going to start taking transit. It's not happening. I think Dylan's right. If we can afford it, we're going to own a vehicle. We might own the vehicle anyway because we're doing a couple of different jobs and getting from point A to point B, even with traffic, is quicker in the vehicle than it is on public transit. That's just the reality of the situation. And I've seen these streets. And I totally agree. I think there is some wishful thinking attached to the desire that we all start taking public transit more often. Maybe someday, but this certainly ain't that day. And we're going to be continuing to experience these growing pains because it's all about creating the housing and not necessarily about creating the infrastructure to support all of the people in those houses, for sure. Jonathan, you're on the Talk Back Hour. Good afternoon.
Afternoon. I just wanted to respond to Sean. I only heard the tail end of what he said in response to me, but first of all, I just want to say sorry, Sean, if you're listening. I really never intended it for it to get to be a heated kind of discussion as it turned out to be. So if you're listening, I hope things are okay now. But I've taken psychology courses and peace and conflict studies courses, and I should have known from all that like, or I've heard the advice, like, don't post online or don't do stuff like that when you're sleep deprived or you're emotionally amped up or whatever, which I think I was, like, as you were correct in your assessment of me, Mike, and thanks for your kind words about me. And, I was sleep deprived. I was coming back for a trip and I was kind of stunned that Pugliese was released or I found out that he was released after looking at different sources. But that was where I was coming from. And you said on your first day on the show here, like, your three pillars or whatever, like transparency and accountability and I forget the other one, but
responsibility.
So I've naively come to expect that from every kind of news source or organization. I have too high expectations of everyone else, but so that's maybe where I was coming from too. So, I guess this kind of show is a lot better. Like, I'm going to try and avoid like comment sections and stuff like that going forward because, this kind of show is a lot better for this kind of discussion. And like, you can hear my tone of voice and or you can hear the anxiety or the timidness in my voice maybe, or the, any other emotion. And like, you can like, yeah, if I was speaking what I was saying to the, like, on the Rangers post there, like you would, it may have, like, in writing, it may have come across as like, yeah, aggressive or whatever, which I understand. So that's why I need to take responsibility and be accountable and transparent myself. So that's what I'm trying to do here. So, thanks, Sean, for responding and for calling me out on stuff too. And I just hope there's no hard feelings anymore. But I understand it. All the best to you, Sean, and Mike too. So,
all right, Jonathan, I appreciate that, and I admire that level of personal accountability, recognizing that your actions and the way that they were interpreted and the condition that you were in when you made the post, right? Maybe you were a little amped up, maybe you're a little sleep deprived, whatever. was not the best time for you to be on social media. But I would take it a step further again, because I really don't understand this. So if somebody says something critical of an organization or frankly even an individual online, when did we, like, this is the whole social media nightmare as far as I'm concerned. What business is it of yours? Did that person or that organization that was criticized, no matter how angrily, since when is it your business to jump in there and start the defending? Like, I just don't get it. This is what we do, right? Oh, I'm gonna show people how great I am because I'm gonna jump on there then and be the defender of all things good, or like this is what social media does to us. Jonathan, again, I appreciate that level of personal accountability, and you know what? Public facing organizations are subject to criticism. It happens. Hopefully we do that in a constructive manner. But when we're not at our best and it's between us and that particular brand or that particular organization, I don't know. I would love to understand the psychology of all of it. The internet justice warriors out there who they're going to make things right. I'm going to step in here and I'm going to fix this. How about we all just take a breath and put down our damn phones once in a while? Unless you're picking up the phone to give me a call on the Talk Back Hour, okay? Because I love a good conversation. Susan, I see you there. We'll get your call next. And there's a line open for you, too, on the Mike Farwell Show. This is 570 News Radio. Every day from noon until 1, you get the chance to have your say about something that's going on in your neighborhood, an idea you want to express, a conversation you've been aching to have. Right back to the phones we go. Susan, good afternoon. You're on the Talk Back Hour.
Hello.
Hello.
I think I'm on the brink of asking a stupid question.
No such thing.
Oh, no. No, no. I've listened to your show.
Wait a minute. Are you saying I ask a lot of stupid questions?
No, the callers.
Oh. Susan, come on now. Okay. Don't be like me. You can be better than me. Okay.
I can.
All right.
Listen. This is, why can't we park on both sides of the street 24/7, 365, like they do in Hamilton? Is that a dumb question?
I don't know that's a dumb question. I wouldn't want you to be able to do it, though. If you parked on both sides of my street, I'd have the nightmare that is school pickup time all day, every day, and I don't want that, thank you. It narrows the street too much.
It does, but everywhere in Hamilton you can do it.
Yeah, well, Hamilton, like, let's talk about the city you're talking about here, Susan. Come on.
Oh, I'm from Sarnia, remember?
Oh, now I remember. Yes, Sarnia. Good old Blue Water Town. Okay.
Yeah. So, okay, all right, so there's no real answer, it's just up to the municipalities how they vote?
Absolutely, they could absolutely create parking on both sides of the street. I just don't believe they do because the streets are awfully narrow as it is.
Okay, great answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. It wasn't a stupid question at all. Just don't go to Hamilton, that's just a stupid thing to do.
Well, you're in trouble.
I know.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. Have a great day. Dear Hamilton, we tease you because we love you, okay? Nothing wrong with the hammer. I mean, nothing much wrong with the hammer. Lisa, you're on the Talk Back Hour. Good afternoon.
Hey, Mike. So the guy that was talking about his street parking sort of drove home another point about this whole electric vehicle thing. You know, I've been thinking, worst case scenario in like Florida right now, where there's people that still don't have electricity after a couple of weeks, or God forbid we get an ice storm up here and there's areas that don't have hydro for a couple of weeks. How in the heck are all those people supposed to have electric cars?
Oh, Lisa, you listen, like, don't even get me started. But I believe, is it next week when we get our economic statement? I don't know, but there's a plan. The province, at least here in Ontario, says it's making a plan to come up with all the supply to meet our future electricity needs.
Yeah, there is just no way Trudeau needs to get his head out of his armhole and rethink what he's talking about with with electric vehicles. On a side note, we just had our second diesel 3500 truck e-tested, because when you are a business, you're legally supposed to do that. And it was 0.2 and you're allowed 10. So if you have a diesel vehicle that is properly maintained, you are green, Mike. So just for anyone that's listening that thinks gas is dirty, it's not if it's taken care of. So
thank you, Lisa.
Anyway, have a good day.
You too. Our vehicles are more fuel efficient than ever. They run cleaner than ever. I'm not denying the impacts nor the concern that is climate change. But I do wonder sometimes if we aren't pointing in the wrong directions here. John, good afternoon. You're on the Talk Back Hour.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I don't get to talk to you as much as I used to, but I'm an avid listener, and maybe that's why we were born with two ears. So always great to hear you, except for when you know what when you're talking about your pro team.
Listen, there's one team that we talk about and another one that we refuse to talk about.
I understand. And both took a kicking. I won't say it starts with an S, but they both took an S kicking last night.
Yes, they did.
Mike, I'd like to just, if I can, a small shout out to the town of Listowel. And I know you've got a lot of listeners out in that area, too. But I've been going back and forth from the KW area to Kincardine and quite and out to Woodstock quite regularly for the last 3 weeks. But it's nice to see that the town of Listowel has put up their Lest We Forget signs in recognition of our veterans. So it's just nice to see that town take more than the 2 minute silence to recognize our true heroes. So I just wanted a small shout out to the good folks in Listowel and the municipality there.
All right, John, I appreciate that call. That would be North Perth, I believe, the municipality in question. Listowel is getting a lot of love on the show today. I also know that St. Mary's, Ontario, has its banners of recognition up ahead of Remembrance Day. New Hamburg, I believe, already has theirs installed. And I think it's the Hespeler area in Cambridge. Forgive me. I should get back down. I haven't been in a while and use my own eyes to confirm this. But 'tis the season. It's not just Listowel is what I want to get around to here. There are other communities that do this. And I'm with you, John. I think it's a really nice thing that we do beyond the 2 minutes on November the 11th. This is the Mike Farwell Show, your 12 o'clock talk back hour, 570 News Radio. Final few minutes of our show today before we turn things over to Rob Snow with Now You Know. Let's maximize our time here on the Talk Back Hour. Lloyd is with us. Good afternoon, Lloyd.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
I'd just like to offer a few comments about electric cars. First of all, last year in Canada, it's only 7% of new cars were electric. Norway, 82%. Electric cars are the future, even though the government has instituted a 100% tariff, which is a tax. And I have two friends who own electric cars. They can understand why they didn't buy one a long time ago. Yes, they are expensive. And mind you, we could take advantage of the Chinese cars. I mean, they really are specializing in EVs. So the industry likes to say that there's not enough charging stations. I drove to BC last year, and let me tell you, there are charging stations everywhere. Can the grid handle it? Absolutely. No problems. That's just industry speak so that they can't give up on internal combustion engine vehicles, because the manufacturers, the big three, have all backed off electric cars. Why? Because they'd rather be making these massive trucks and SUVs from which they get massive profits. And they can't give those up. And yeah, you know, some jobs would be affected in Canada, but however, the future is EVs. Anyway, that's my rant for today.
All right, Lloyd. I appreciate it. That's what the 12 o'clock talk back hour is for. And clearly, Lloyd is an EV evangelist, and I'm happy for him in that place. The price point is one of the greatest barriers to entry for me to the EV market. As I mentioned, we're running right up against the clock. An update from the 570 News Center, and then Now You Know with Rob Snow between 1 and 3. Looking ahead at our show tomorrow, an interesting decision on the part of Cambridge when it comes to its intentions for naming rights on community buildings, including the Preston Memorial Auditorium. We'll talk about that on the show tomorrow. And Ontario's big city mayors say, hey, we need some help getting some legislative change that may lead us towards involuntary treatment for addictions and mental health. We'll talk about that on the show tomorrow and more. Devin Robertson is our guy on the other side of the glass. My name is Mike Farwell. Bye for now.